We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on Illinois Public Media, AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Well, we've all heard that less can be more, yet rather than embracing less, we're more likely to be in the pursuit of more. This afternoon, we're going to turn our attention to Less as More. Our guest is writer Cecile Andrews. She is most recently co-editor with Wanda Urbanska of a collection of essays about simplicity and the simplicity movement. The title, Less is More, Embracing Simplicity for a Healthy Planet, a Caring Economy, and Lasting Happiness. The book contains works by people who have been thinking about and writing about simplicity for some time now, including Bill McKibben, Sarah Susanka, and Juliet Shore. The overall theme of the essays is this: with less stuff, less work, and less debt, we find ourselves with more time, more satisfaction, and more security. Our guest, Cecile Andrews, says, simplicity is about creating a life you love, a life that brings you joy and peace of mind. Listeners, join the discussion with your questions and comments. I look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. Our guest, Cecile Andrews, holds a doctorate in education from Stanford University. She is the author of Circle of Simplicity and Slow is Beautiful, and co-founder of Finney Eco Village in Seattle. Less is More is published by New Society Publishers. Again, the phone numbers, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Cecile Andrews, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
My pleasure to talk with you this afternoon.
Great to be here.
At the outset of a piece that's contained in this collection, Less is More, the title is The Circle of Simplicity, and the biographical sketch about you, because you penned The Circle of Simplicity, says this about you: you regard yourself as the hedonist of the simplicity movement. Tell us about that. How did you come to describe yourself like that?
Well, the simplicity movement, I see it as the examined life in which we're asking what's important and what matters. But most people interpret that as some sort of, you know, oh, God, I got to give up everything. And so I've had people say to me, you know, what's that movement you're involved in, that self-deprivation movement? And I realize that that's what people think, and that you're not supposed to be, you're doing it wrong if you're not enjoying your life more. This really is creating a life you can love. And too many people who are attracted to simplicity want to have that kind of ascetic approach. And, you know, it's not about denying yourself. And so I'm always pushing and saying, no, we're supposed to be enjoying ourselves. And in my subtitle for my Slow is Beautiful book, I talk about the important things are community, leisure, and joie de vivre. And so many people these days don't even know what joie de vivre means, the joy of living, from France. And so I've come to see myself as the hedonist in this movement.
Yeah. Well, what are the roots of the simplicity movement?
Oh, wow. It goes back. It goes back to the beginning. People have always talked about don't fall into the trap of thinking you're going to be happy if you're rich or you're famous. It's in all major religions. And it's interesting because it is a particularly American theme that can be traced throughout American history. Obviously, the Puritans when they came over. But what happened is, you know, we became very successful in this country. And so there has been this constant tension between having too much and realizing what you've lost when you have too much, that you lose this sense of peace of mind because you're out there grasping and striving. So it's an American theme in particular, and I find that fascinating, that it really is an American theme.
In the introduction to this book, you say about simplicity that it involves cutting through commercial static. That says the consumer society is the good life. Well, that static is very noisy. How do you begin to cut through it?
Well, I think for most people, as I said, I think of it as this examined life, that you have to build into your life some sort of reflection of asking yourself, you know, is this what I choose? And asking yourself, how will this decision affect my well-being and the well-being of the planet? Those two go together. But the really best thing is to get together with other people and talk about it. It's really the best form of reflection. And I've kind of spent many years getting people involved in simplicity circles. And in fact, one person said when they saw me organizing yet again another small group, she said, "Oh, Cecile, you're doing it again. You must have been a sheepdog in a former life." And I thought, well, yes, indeed, that's my role. And this coming together and talking with people is becoming bigger and bigger in terms of people understanding that it's important for psychological health, it's important for social change. You know, the recent things have been coming out. There's a book called Connected, talking about our social networks, like our real-life social networks, not online, that, you know, they're saying, you know, if you're happy, your friend will be happy and their friend will be happy, that things are catching, that it moves through social networks. So bringing people together to talk about this, because it's very hard, as you said, to resist the constant message to consume more, to work longer, to get more money, that you'll be happier with more money. And the truth is, after a certain point, more money does not bring more happiness. And in fact, it can go the other way because it detracts from the real source of happiness, which is social ties. So it's really important to start your own simplicity circle. Anybody could do it. And that you come together and you talk about how you're trying to simplify your life.
Okay. So talk a little bit more about a simplicity circle. How do you pull one together? And how do you get it going? How do you sustain it?
Well, two things. One, in the back of Circle of Simplicity, I have that. But I also have, in Less is More, the final chapter is how you can form a group. And particularly, we did this book, Less is More, with all these different people writing about simplicity. And we asked them to make their essays very short because people don't have much time to read. And so that if people form a group around the book, that means people can read their essay like right before they come, and then they can also remember it, which people have trouble doing too. So we give the kind of directions of how to do it. Nobody has to be an expert, but we always kind of, you can discuss the short essay, then you talk about what you're doing in your life to try to live more simply. And most people are doing things like, you know, trying to drive less, trying to cut back on energy, and in particular trying to consume less, trying to buy less. And it's funny how much better that goes when you're talking with other people, because you get ideas. Like one person in one of my simplicity circles always knows the best thrift stores and consignment shops, and somebody else knows where to get recycled things, and somebody else comes up with an idea about, or they talk about good movies, that when you share this with each other, it's much more likely to help you change. And one thing that we're stressing more is to link what's going on in simplicity with what's going on in the national news, that this is not just a personal change issue. It's about major policy changes. And for instance, I think that this whole thing about health care is so important to living more simply, because a lot of people, if they had universal health care, could afford to work fewer hours. They could work half-time, because a lot of people are clinging to those full-time jobs because they have to have their benefits. And so if you have something like that, health care, you will be able to live more simply. And so it's important not just to see this as like I'm trying to clear the clutter out of my closets. We're really trying to bring about a big social movement that, to use Obama's phrase, create a culture in which we're all in this together, that it's not just every man for himself. And at the heart of American kind of belief system is this belief system that if you're rich, you'll be happy. And until we challenge that, people will keep thinking about that, and they won't question our wealth gap. They'll just think, I've got to get mine. And you'll never live simply as long as you believe that.
You write that research has shown that the pursuit of wealth doesn't make us happy, and that the biggest predictor of the health of a nation as measured in longevity is the wealth gap. What kind of research has been done on the pursuit of wealth and the wealth gap?
Well, all sorts of stuff. There's one book in particular by Wilkinson that's just come out that really covers all of it. It's called The Spirit Level. And that's kind of one of those tools carpenters use to keep things on the level. And what they found over and over in research on comparing countries, comparing states in the United States in particular, even counties, is as the wealth gap widens, people's longevity goes down. We have shorter lives. Now, first of all, you'd think, well, with more poor people and their health is worse, this will bring down the average. But it's more than that. The rich person in this country does not live as long as the rich person in a place like Holland or Denmark, where there's a smaller wealth gap. Now, why is that? One of the biggest hypotheses on this is that the wealth gap destroys social ties. You no longer feel we're all in this together. And so you will have rich people saying, we're not giving money to those welfare cheats, and you'll have them worrying that they're going to be the victims of crime. And so the social ties are broken in a country. And again, we can't live simply when there is this constant feeling of a cutthroat society. This you're not going to have this sense of inner peace. You're also always going to be after more and striving. So this idea about the wealth gap, just when I first ran across this, it's just like, wow, this is incredible. It's saying that equality works best, because in equality, we really care for each other, and that is the core of happiness. And it's so hard to really get away from that in our competitive society. So I'm so glad you brought that up, because I consider this to be just really at the heart of the simplicity movement. Whereas most people, as I say, often think it's just about, you know, saving money or clearing out your clutter. Mm-hmm. It's just so much bigger than that.
Yeah. Well, one of the things going back, though, to the personal and spending and overconsumption, this was kind of interesting, and I'd like to share it with the audience. In one of the pieces, like Corn in the Night, Reclaiming a Sense of Time, mm-hmm. The author writes, cites Juliet Shore, who has noted that over the past 30 years, real consumption expenditures per person have doubled, adjusted for inflation, from $11,171 to $22,152. And the author says her analysis reveals a double-edged sword that has emerged, particularly in the 80s and 90s, that we are working and working and working so we can spend and spend and spend.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And as we work harder, we have to spend more money for things we don't do ourselves, as we work longer, I should say. So we're buying prepared foods. We're not cooking at home. We don't have time to take mass transit, so we drive. You know, when we think back, you know, to the 50s, and it's interesting, in the 50s we had the most equality, the smallest wealth gap, and people had more time. And you think of people sewing and making their clothes, and you know, you could do many more things, people fixing their own cars, that as we've worked longer and longer hours, all this has fallen by the wayside. And it not only affects us in our lack of time and our expenditures, but this affects the planet because we have less time, as I say, to take mass transit. Eating processed foods is not only bad for us, it's bad for the planet. And so all of these things are tied together. And time really is one of the central things. And we have found in the Simplicity Movement that we can get more people to pay attention to the issue of time almost than the issue of saving money. Now, the saving money has obviously come back up in this last year, but the issue of time that we are, people are finally understanding, you know, one of the only countries, almost not only industrialized countries, but poor countries, who don't have vacation policies or parental leaves or sick leave, that if you're in the European Union, there's a guaranteed 4 weeks of vacation, and most have 4 to 6 weeks vacation, or they have a shorter work week, and they are just as productive as we are, if not more. And it's interesting because this is obviously a quality of life issue, and Americans are really pushed to the nth degree. We can't go much faster. Yet as jobs don't pick up from the recession, the people who are left working harder and harder, and then things seem to be falling apart. Nobody can do a good job. So it's this issue of time is particularly important, and we actually have, and this is interesting, a bill that's in the House to guarantee Americans 1 week of vacation. And, of course, you know, the right wing just thinks, oh, this is horrible. You know, why do you give anybody any time off? They should be working. Well, and the person who introduced it is Grayson, who has been this wonderful representative talking about health care. And so he's taking this risk, this representative from Florida, of really saying, you know, look, we need a different kind of culture. It's not just little things. It's big things, and particularly more time. So we're really excited about that.
Yeah. Is this a bipartisan movement, or is it pretty much a liberal movement?
Oh, I know. It's pretty much a liberal, pretty much a progressive one. I think, I mean, we all know that the Republican Party right now is taken over by the real right wing, and we certainly have some old-fashioned Republicans who say, you know, look, you're talking about family values. Well, you need time for family values. You want people to go to church. You want them to volunteer. You need more time for this. But this certainly is not the voice of the Republicans that we're hearing right now. And, you know, when I come back to the social ties, that this is so important, that what we have the right wing doing right now is really stirring up anger and hatred between people. And again, you don't live simply when you don't have a sense of peace of mind when you feel anger and hatred toward people. So I wish it were more bipartisan. As I say, there are some old-fashioned Republicans. You know, in Eisenhower's day, the income tax at the highest rate was 91%. And as I say, we had the lowest gap between the rich and the poor. And people will say to me, well, in the 50s, things weren't as good for women and black people or gays. Well, that's when these movements started. That's when the civil rights. Rosa Parks was 1955, and Brown versus Board of Education, 54, and the women's movement, Betty Friedan, was in 63, but she did the research in the 50s. So it's just that, you know, it should be bipartisan, but it's not really right now.
Yeah. Also, here's another important question I think you should address. Is simplicity essentially a concept for the middle and upper classes?
It is a concept of that in terms of change. I would never talk to poor people and say you need to simplify your lives. What they need is more money in order to live simply. They need policies that give them a higher wage. However, the idea of simplicity is crucial to the fate of poor people, because why is it that poor people have so little money? They're paid too little, and the corporations are saying we deserve to have all this money. And in fact, as long as people believe that if they're rich they will be happy, they don't mind when the rich get tax cuts, because they think that someday they will be one of those rich people and they will be happier. And in fact, and I'm sure this has changed within the last year or so, but it was 80% of people thought that if they worked hard enough, they could be rich. And it is simply not true. But this whole belief system that if I'm rich, I'll be happy, I can work hard enough, and I will be rich. Therefore, I don't mind if there's a wealth gap. And so this is what affects poor people. The drive for more profits, and of course everybody needs some profit, but the drive for extreme profits is what drives us into war. It's what drives us. It's what drove Madoff. It's what drives corporations to do things that destroy the environment. So this pursuit of wealth as the answer to happiness has ramifications for poor people. But you're right. I never would go. I would, you know, in fact, I need to be talking to people like me, essentially middle class, because that's the only people we can really save, is when we talk to people about our own experiences. And it would have to be a poor person talking about the importance of people reducing their consumerism. But they wouldn't be telling poor people to reduce their consumerism. So I'm glad you asked that. That's such an important point.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Cecile Andrews. She is co-editor with Wanda Urbanska of Less is More, Embracing Simplicity for a Healthy Planet, a Caring Economy, and Lasting Happiness. We're talking this afternoon about simplicity and the simplicity movement. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. There are a couple of thoughts here that I think we should explore. One question is, as we continue to struggle with the impact of this very serious recession, do you see the simplicity movement coming into its own, or do you see, I sense that there's a lot of fear out there, and people are not going to slow down because they want to hang on to their job, or they want to get another job. What do you think?
Well, I think that is what's happening, and that's why we have to be a voice that says we've got to rethink things. I like the words of Studs Terkel right before he died when they interviewed him about what to do about the Depression, and he said, the lessons of the Great Depression, one, don't blame yourself, turn to others, take part in the community. The big boys are not that bright, which I just love. And we've got to keep challenging people to say we can't go back to the old ways. But one piece of research that's really surprised people is during the recession, they have found that people's health has improved. Mortality has gone up, even though there are suicides for people who have been affected by the recession. Now, why is that? With people working less, and you know, it's not by choice necessarily, but they are taking more time to eat better. They're not going out to restaurants as much. They're having people over. They're with friends and family. They're walking more. They're biking more. And so this has kind of blown people away. And people say, well, you know, this after a while, the effects. It's not. We're not saying we want a recession. but we're saying that there are some surprising consequences of a recession when people work less. And we've got to get that message out to people. Again, the importance of time to do things that make you healthier and happier, and that this is one of the unintended surprising gifts that we have had from the recession. So, you know, but again, it's to get people to think and take a look and ask what's important, what matters. And whenever there is a kind of a disaster, when there's a challenge, a crisis, it should make us stop and think and ask us what direction do we want to go in.
Hmm. One of the pieces I enjoyed reading and thinking about was written by Jerome Siegel. Mm-hmm. The title is Graceful Living. He writes about gracefulness both in its religious sense and as an aesthetic. And he concludes, essentially, that this means giving of oneself while at the same time being receptive to the gifts of others. Mm-hmm. How might we create opportunities for that kind of openness?
Well, you know, one of the things that I try to do a lot is just have people over. Now, people quit having people over because nobody had time, and they thought, well, you know, I've got to have this elaborate dinner, and the house has to be perfect, and I can never manage that. So I myself have really low standards, and so we invite people over, like for a movie night. You know, somebody brings a popcorn, somebody brings a dessert, because people have discovered that when they come to my house, I don't make anything, so they better bring this stuff. and so they feel there's an informality about it, and it makes things, you know, a chance to talk, and we try to watch maybe a funny movie. We love to do Peter Sellers or Harold and Maude or something that's obviously these are old movies, but something that makes people laugh together. And so to me, there's nothing better than an evening when you're laughing with friends. I mean, I can't think of anything I would rather do. So I spend my time trying to do that sort of thing a lot. Or we have a big neighborhood movement that's going on in Seattle, and it's going on across the country as well, but particularly in places like Seattle and Boulder and you know Vancouver, BC, that we're trying to bring community and sustainability, that those two things, in fact, Bill McKibben says, we won't have sustainability unless we have community. And so people have, you know, chicken coop raisings. You know, they help each other build a chicken coop, or we have something we call our Stop and Chat campaign. You know, we got this from Larry David, you know, with Seinfeld, the Curb Your Enthusiasm, because he hates Stop and Chats. You know, he'll cross the street before he'll talk to somebody. So we say, get out and talk to your neighbors. Hang out. You know, have a good time. And it's like, whoa, you know, what happened to this culture that we have to be reminding people to do that? But it's so important, and this is where this gracefulness comes, because it doesn't sound big, but stopping and chatting with people in your neighborhood, there is something that makes you feel like you're a part of something. And Robert Putnam, the author of Bowling Alone, says that the culture in which people talk to their neighbors over the back fence is the culture in which people will vote. That democracy, and John Dewey said, democracy is born in conversation. That people will have this receptiveness and this openness when they decide that this is a priority in their lives. And it's not hard. You can just, you know, I you know, talk to people and standing in line and as you walk around and be pleasant. You know, there's so much unpleasantness out there these days that what an antidote to have a stop and chat. So, you know, and this is a personal thing. This is something you can do. Everybody can go out today. And, you know, some people say, oh, that sounds really sappy. You know, we should be talking about important things. No, you know, tell people a joke that you've heard. I have a friend who always has a joke. One of the other things we do in these neighborhood organizations we decided that we called it the Home Alone Group, but nobody liked that because it sounded too pathetic. But it is to bring people together who are working at home during the day, and they lose their community. So we go to a neighborhood cafe, and we're only there to chat with each other, and it's a weekly thing. And, you know, we laugh and we talk, and we're in a local cafe, so we're supporting our local neighborhood businesses. And, you know, this is something we can do, and it has much more import than one would suspect. So I love that particular chapter, too.
Let's take a call from a listener waiting for us in Paw Paw on line 4. Hi.
Yeah, good afternoon, Celeste. You're bringing up the fact of, you know, voting, getting out, being aware of who you're voting for. I think we were lacking that. We're supposed to be a democracy or a republic, but we're not, because people don't participate or don't choose to. And I hear excuses all the time. Well, you know, when I used to work 24/7, I made it a point to go to polling places and vote. I made it aware to pay attention to what's going around me in where I live, and participate as much as I could. Now, you'll hear anything from, well, I don't have time, I've got kids I got to take care of, I can't do that. You know, they got to take them to soccer practice or football or baseball or something. Well, which is fine, but 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes tops out of your time to vote. It's all it takes. People just don't want to do the political thing. And I think we've gotten in a time in this country where people need to educate themselves about who they're voting for. You no longer can say, well, I'm Democratic, I'm going to go vote Democratic. I'm Republican, I'm going to go vote for Republican. I vote as I would hire a person to work for me. Educate yourself and go who you think in your heart would be the best that would help you out. We don't do that anymore. We just throw our hands up and just go, eeny, meeny, miny, moe. And my question to you is, how far does this country have to go before you think people start paying attention not only to the major elections but to the minor ones around the local municipalities? Because I don't see vote turnouts. I don't see the education that people need to know about these people. Do you see it ever getting better? Mm-hmm. And if so, you know, when? I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, that's a great question. And I think one of the things is that people have to see that engagement is really enjoyable. So that we have to be, when we have meetings about some issue, we can't just be angry. We can't just be saying we've got to change this. We've got to say, you know, turn to your neighbor and talk for a little bit. You know, make it welcoming. Make it something that people want to do. And we've got to realize that any social event, participation of any sort, increases people's likelihood that they will vote. That's just the way it is. And it's great that you go ahead and make sure you vote. And that's great. But a lot of people don't do it. And so even if you get people to come over for a potluck, you're making it more likely that they will vote. If we can get them to a PTA meeting, it is more likely. But you got to make the PTA meetings enjoyable. We've got to make it something that people want to do. So this is all connected, both personal change and policy change. And it really does come to, you know, how do you bring people together to get them to enjoy being with each other? Because then that's the real democracy, is participation.
Yeah, it also sounds like maybe the listener was getting thinking about reallocating our time a little bit in terms of, you know, like you said, you know, maybe, as you said, the stop and chat, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and then you go on, and maybe you say, hey, at the end of the week, let's get together. It seems to me we get into a rut and we do the same things over and over and over again, and it seems like we don't take the time to say, do I really have to do this?
Yes. So again, simplicity, as I say, is the examined life. and take time to ask yourself, you know, is this how I want to spend my time? Is this what's the result? And maybe you do it at a family dinner that you all talk. Well, how was your day? You know, maybe you know, a husband and wife have a time where they build it in, where they talk with each other, or for yourself, that every day you have at least 5 minutes just to sit and reflect. And people don't notice how they feel. And one of the interesting things I discovered recently in a book called Lonely in America is that depression has spiked in this country. But the author says that a lot of this is loneliness, but that we cannot even recognize when we're lonely. So we consume a pill. So again, it comes back to reaching out, and that just has so many consequences.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. What do you or your book have to say about what I might call the cult of shopping? This is kind of a semi-joke to a lot of people, but others are wearing sweatshirts that say, shop till you drop. I heard there was one woman who was buried in her sweatshirt saying, shop till you drop.
No.
And our former president urged people to go shopping, go to the mall, go out and buy stuff, spend money because the economy depends upon it. And 70% of the national economy is supported by consumer spending. So what is your response to all that? I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, again, they found that shopping does not make people happy. But I don't like shaking my finger at people and saying, stop doing that. I want to say that here's something that's much more enjoyable. And so if people had places to gather at night, people had, you know, sidewalk cafes, they're much less likely to shop. This has been research that's shown this, that places that countries that have a pub or a cafe or, you know, a bar that people go to, they're much less likely to shop. So one of the ways to do something about shopping is to create these places to gather. But shopping, we have to reduce our shopping because this is one of the things that's destroying the planet. We're using up resources. We're using oil. It destroys people's savings, and we've seen what's happened recently with that. And people say, well, what about the economy? Well, we respond when people say that with, what's the economy for? Is it to make a few people very rich, or is it for the greater good, for the greater number? And if we change the profit motive, not just the profit motive in this country, but the upper wealth accumulation, we make more equality, then we have a different kind of culture, and we can shop less. We can afford it, but we cannot go on with the shopping. So that's a really important issue. But I say give them something more fun to do, and that'll make a big difference.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and today we're turning our attention to Less as More. Our guest is writer Cecile Andrews, most recently co-editor of a collection of essays about simplicity. The title, Less is More, Embracing Simplicity for a Healthy Planet, a Caring Economy, and Lasting Happiness. I want to go back to our first caller and his comments about voting. I wonder if strong neighborhoods are predictors of good turnout in elections.
Yes, definitely, definitely. Because strong neighborhoods, and often they become strong because they've come together over an issue. In our neighborhoods in Seattle, we would fight different issues, and people would learn, for one, how to become involved. A lot of people are, they think they don't know how to do it. They don't know how to go to a meeting, and they don't know how to speak up. And you tend to vote when you've been involved. So that's a really, really important issue, that if we want to get people to vote, it's not enough just to harangue them, but it's to give them possibilities for participation ahead of time. So strong neighborhoods do predict that.
Yeah, so you come together around a school, or you're a park, or or concerns about crime.
That's it exactly. That's exactly what it does. And what's important is when you bring people together around those issues is to build in helping people have community and getting to know each other. So it's not just about the issue, and that they will keep getting together afterwards, and it's not just about, oh, we only come together when there's something wrong. But it's a possibility. And so anything and any issue like that is your chance to really not just to make a difference on the issue, but in the whole democracy.
Earlier this afternoon here in our conversation, you talked about making real-life connections as opposed to online connections.
Mm-hmm.
Computers and cell phones and other relatively new technologies have had such a huge impact on our lives. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's something that we at least have to talk about, particularly because for young people, you know, this is the way they communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And I've asked young people, I've said, how do you feel walking across campus all hooked up and that you're not going to have a stop and chat? And often they have to come up to me afterwards and say, you know, I really wish it were different. I wish I could just walk across, but I'm afraid that if I'm not, don't have my earphones in, you know, people will either think I'm odd or if I try to say hello, they won't respond. And so I just think it's something we have to talk about, and I certainly use online stuff to create more real face-to-face community. I mean, I use it to organize all sorts of things, and so this is an important part of it, but people can't forget that it's the face-to-face that contributes to well-being for the individual and for the whole community.
Yeah. I read an article online. It was an interview that you gave this fall, and in it you reveal that you have an iPhone.
I know, it's so shocking. I wrote a column that said, "Can a simplicity advocate find happiness with an iPhone?" And I absolutely love this iPhone. I love it, and I use it all the time. And for me, it has simplified my life because it's eliminated. I use it as a radio. I use it as a television. I use it as a voice recorder. I use it as a camera. And I use it as a GPS. I mean, I used to carry all this stuff around with me. And so, yes, I love it. But, you know, again, if you just let it take over, everything in this culture has to be a part of a conscious decision. It's living deliberately, as Thoreau said, that you can't just do things because we're so manipulated by mass media that we have to constantly resist it. But yes, I have an iPhone.
Yeah. Yesterday I talked with a journalist. Our guest was Hank Stuever, who has written a book about Christmas, and it touches on a lot of other topics. It's called Tinsel. And we talked about how it is that at this time of the year we'll see lots of second caller this afternoon mentioned a shop till you drop sweatshirt. But, you know, you can buy a sweatshirt that says believe at this time of the year or a mug or whatever. And here it is, we're being given this direction to believe in a land of make-believe.
Isn't it incredible? I know. And it's so, you know, this time of the year, you think, well, you know, what was the message of Jesus? You know, it was to love people. It wasn't to shop. And it's just like so clear, but it just gets totally lost. And so I can barely stand to have anything to do with Christmas, unfortunately. I just like to totally escape from it because, you know, we're all still victims of that. Oh, you've got to go out and buy people the perfect present. You've got to find that perfect present. And it just is too stressful. And I know so many people who say, I can hardly wait for the holidays to be over. Well, that's not the way we should be living. Holidays should make us feel more alive and bring us together and happy. And they don't do that anymore. And so, again, you know, we have to challenge almost everything, unfortunately, of the American kind of culture. But one of the things Americans have is that we change things. We have energy, and we get up and make a difference. And so that's one of the American virtues that we can hang on to.
Let's take one last call. We'll have to be quick, though. We've got about a minute left. Champagne, line one. Hi.
Hi. I'll be very quick. I love the idea that you are encouraging just simple conversations. My long Latin memory going back says con, com, with or together, conversations building community. I think if we had more real conversation, we would of necessity have a little more civility, a little more kindness, and a little more care for one another. So great topic. Thanks so much. I'll hang up. Bye-bye.
Okay. Cecile?
Perfect ending. Perfect.
Okay. All right. There we will leave it. Cecile Andrews, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. It was great.
Cecile Andrews, together with Wanda Urbanska, are co-editors of Less is More, Embracing Simplicity for a Healthy Planet, a Caring Economy, and Lasting Happiness. The book is published by New Society Publishers.